Hi, everybody. It's not Monday. It's actually Tuesday. I want to thank Rav Rafi, Dr. Shochet for switching with me this week. But we're not changing our we're not going to be changing our MO. We're not going to be changing our topic. It's Tuesday, time for Pirkei Avot, History and Hashkafa. And we were in the beginning, in the middle. Oh, first of all, I hope everybody had an easy and meaningful fast. This year, I think it meant pretty much staying inside, considering the heat. But I was just outside, and apparently, it's not as bad as it's been. So, thank God for small things. We are in the middle of the second chapter of Pirkei Avot. We are on Mishnah, according to this edition, Mishnah number four. And last time we talked about community, and we talked about what does it mean to separate oneself from the community. We could really talk about that for a very, very long time. But you know, we want to keep moving. One thing I think that is very, very important to keep in mind in terms of Al Tifrosh Ma'atzibur, and we saw the kinds of, what should I call them, the kinds of exigencies that can lead an individual to decide to leave, the community, or to try, if he thinks that the community's influence on his spiritual and moral being, well-being, is just horrible. So he has a license to separate himself, but really only in extremis. There's another element to Al Tifrosh Ma'atzibur, which I think is important to keep in mind as well. We carry, every Jew carries double loads, whether they want to or not. We are, on the one hand, individuals, not in the Monty Python sense, you know, like we're all individuals, and they all scream, we're all individuals. And one guy says, I'm not. We're all individuals. We all have our individual relationship with God. We are, at the same time, constantly and from birth, bound to a people. Now, that's very not au courant, because in identitarian politics, in identitarian culture, there's no such thing. In other words, I decide who I join. Nobody can make a priori demands on me. But the Torah says, no, you are born as an individual, and you are also born into a people, and the people has a right to make demands on you. Now, how that plays out is your business, but that's an a priori situation which you have to deal with. It's a very, very different way of looking at things. Why am I mentioning this? Because that a priori connection with a people, with a nation, can lead to all kinds of tensions in a person's life. It can lead to tensions in a person's life when you make choices which seem to put you at odds with the people. That can put you at odds, that can create situations in post-1948 of the accusation or the possibility of dual loyalty between one's native land and between one's obligation to other Jews, which, by the way, is quite an extraordinary thing when one considers the fact that Jews have always stood up for one another and made sacrifices one for another, irrespective of state of Israel, no state of Israel, where other nations did. In other words, in most cases, ethnic groups, when they move, they maintain some kind of connection with the mother country, one generation, two generations, maybe three, but not much more than that. Throughout Jewish history, Jews from all over the world have always mobilized when other Jews were in trouble. It didn't matter where. We have cases of money being raised in Italy to send to Yemen. And in Yemen, we know that the Jews were praying and trying to support the Jews in Soviet Russia. This kind of double load that we carry is a very, very serious and very innate part of the way that Jewish civilization and the way that the Torah tries to develop our own each person's persona. How each of us deals with it is another story, but it is definitely a built-in part of the part of being Jewish in the traditional sense. And I think we have to keep that in mind because that is the reason why Jewish ethnic national ties transcend religious observance. Make that again. Judaism is not a religion. It's a very complex, unprecedented combination of a religion which is melded with national identity and ethnic identity, and trying to parse it is very, very difficult. But that the two elements play off against each other, are integral to each other, is a historical given. Anything other than that is really a distortion. Anyways, so that's Al Tifrosh Matzibur is not so simple. Al Tifrosh Matzibur also means Al Tifrosh not just from your community, but from your people and from your nationality, and it's a very, as I said. Okay, anyway, so that's one perhaps somewhat contemporary piece of this. And again, it's not necessarily related to whether you're a Zionist or not a Zionist. It's got to do with being Jew and feeling personally responsible for Jews elsewhere. I remember, in fact, I think one of the most beautiful sights I ever saw was during Mifza, I forget which one is first, Moshe Ushlomo in 1984-85, when the first massive airlift of Ethiopian Jews took place, and there was a worldwide campaign to help pay ransoms and to get the Jews out of Ethiopia where they were threatened. And the response, I'll never forget, was incredible. These are Jews who nobody had ever seen before. They were black Jews. Everybody knew they were black Jews. But Jews were endangered. Maybe it was a lesson from the Shoah. I don't know. But the response in terms of activism, in terms of money, in terms of all kinds of support was just incredible. That's the flip side of Al Tifrosh Matzibur, irrespective of any other consideration. Okay, so as I said, we could talk about this for a long time. Let's go on. Says Hillel, and most scholars think this really is a statement by the first century BCE and the first century CE sage Hillel. There are manuscripts, by the way, that say Rabbi Hillel says. Why is there a resh there? Because we dealt with Hillel in the first chapter. So how come all of a sudden we're talking about Hillel now? We're like a few generations later if the Mishnayot are cited chronologically. So sometimes it happens that a scribe will take the liberty to solve the problem by adding a Rebbe, which would mean that this is a rabbi who lived later, but not necessarily the famous Hillel. But most scholars think that this is really a passage from Hillel. How it ended up being stuck into this Mishnah later, that's boring. We don't have to talk about that now. Anyways, so Mishnah goes on. After says Al Tifrosh Matzibur, don't separate yourself from the community. The Mishnah says Va'al Tamen Batzmacha Ad Yom Mutcha. Don't believe in yourself until the day that you die. Don't judge your fellow until you get to his place. Or as the famous, I don't know if this is true, but I was told this as a kid, that there is a parallel Native American saying, do not judge your friend until you've walked a mile in his moccasins. Okay, same idea. V'al tomar davar she'efshar lishmoa she'sofar lishamea. Don't say something which should not be heard or is impossible to hear or when it should be forbidden to say or to hear, because in the end it's going to come out. And finally, Al-Tomar, don't say, I'm going to get around to studying. Want to get around to it because you might not have time. Each one of these, can't help it, sorry. It's going to be a month till we get out of this mission, or at least 3 weeks. Let's start. Excuse me. Don't believe in yourself until the day you die. Now, obviously, nobody knows when they're going to die. So this is a very dramatic way of saying, don't be, what's the word? Not self-satisfied. I'm having a linguistic senior moment here. Don't be self-satisfied. Don't be self-satisfied. In other words, don't be sure of yourself. Now, we mentioned this at the end of the previous year, that all of the commentaries jump in and tell a story about Yochanan Horkanos, who was the son of Simon the Havismanian, in other words, the grandson of Mattathias, that he was a Pharisee, he was on the right, correct team as far as history is concerned, he was the proto-Rabbinites, the oral law, and so on. And at the end of his life, he ended up going bad and becoming a Sadducee. What's the point? What's the point? So I told you last week, the beautiful sort of Dvar Torah that Rabbi Moshe Bezdin, Zichron Levracha, told me about why the altar is on a ramp and not steps. I want to take it one step further. What does it mean not to believe in yourself? Of course, you're supposed to believe in yourself. So the answer. So I think what we're talking about is the fact that one always has to. Self-satisfaction is a terrible thing because you don't grow. You always have to be hungry. You have to be aware of your deficiencies. Arrogance, intellectual arrogance, spiritual arrogance. Having the temerity to dictate policy as if you're a prophet is, or to arrogate to yourself authority, especially religious authority, that you really don't deserve, is one of the sources of corruption of religion. If it comes with charisma, it's even worse. I've often thought that one of the worst things a person can have is charisma. Because it can easily divert you, send you down the dark side, and not keep you on the light side of the force. Al tamen ba'atzmecha also means that you're the tools that you have to deal with life up until now may not be the same ones that are going to fit. That's going to fit later on in the Mishnah. And finally. And this is something which I don't think this is shot in the Mishnah. I don't think this is a simple meaning of the Mishnah, but it's an interesting example of what I've told you consistently throughout, the year, more than a year that we've been doing this. And maybe someday we'll do it in person. Who knows? Not if the Delta variant keeps getting stronger. In this commentary on Pirkei Avot, which I love, by my friend and colleague Zev Safrai, he makes the following comment, which I really, as I said, I don't think it has to do anything to do with the Mishnah itself, but I think it's a contemporary moment. What have I told you? That the way of looking at Pirkei Avot, it's a multi-levered, multi-leveled, multi-layered, very nuanced work. What Pirkei Avot is on the one hand, it's ages past sharing their wisdom with us, and yet we understand this. It's similar to something that's called reception theory. So they said something which is apparently straightforward. On the other hand, we respond or we react to the words of the past in terms of our present, in terms of our present circumstances, in terms of things that concern us. That's just normal. Professor Safrai Zev says as follows: Al tamen ba'atzmecha ad yom mutcha. Don't believe in yourself until your dying day. Is also a warning to others that the people that they admire are vulnerable. In other words, a person to whom I attribute moral clarity, probity, scholarship, piety, all of the, and sagacity, all of those qualities which a person would look for in a leader, and we all look for leaders that are greater than us in one degree or another. Nobody's totally self-sufficient. We should realize that nobody's perfect, and in fact, anybody can fail. Anybody can be, again, I'll go back to Star Wars, anybody can be seduced by the dark side. Oh, says Professor Safrai, hence, one should never put total faith in another human being, because they may also, like Yochanan Kohen Gadol, end up going bad. Hence, okay, that's so odd, kind of just, to this point, I've just repeated what I said before, but then he goes on and says, therefore the veneration of living saints is being directly criticized by Hillel. Which raises another question. So that's obviously something bothers him. It's not necessarily the watch how this is going on. The Mishnah is talking about don't trust yourself, don't be self-satisfied, don't be smug, don't be arrogant. It's about you. Comes Professor Safrai and says, and you should not. And from looking at you on the outside, you also have to pay attention and not and are reliant on somebody and realize that they can go bad too. Now, we've seen unfortunately, in recent years, religious and political and ostensibly moral individuals really, like, go down the tubes, in this very same context. But it raises obviously this is something which is bothering him, because it doesn't suggest itself necessarily from the words. That does raise another issue, which I should at least note, and that is, okay, what about a guy who made it to the finish line? What about a guy who is, by all accounts, pious and honest and full of integrity, and then he dies or she dies? So, should you believe in them? In other words, is there room, by implication, is there room in Judaism for veneration of saints, saint worship? Now, this is very, very common in other religions. It raises the question of intercessionary prayer. Are we allowed to, would a Jew be allowed to turn to the soul of a person who made it to the finish line, who is deserving of faith in the sense of trust and admiration? To intercede with God on our behalf. Now, you get this in Catholicism. This is definitely there in Greek Orthodox. You have it. Certainly in Eastern religions, you have it. So the question: what about us? Now, I'm sure some of you are listening and thinking, well, you know, there's this whole thing about going to Kivrot Tzadikim, going to the graves of the righteous. There are those who go to the Cave of Machpelah, and there are people that go up to Meron, and unfortunately this year was a tragedy, and they go and they pray at the grave of the saint, and is that legitimate or is it not? So here it's a very, very sticky, it's a very sticky business. See, on the one hand, there is absolutely no room. I mean, it exists. I'm not saying it doesn't, but there is no room formally for intercessionary prayer in Judaism, period. You pray directly to God. The only being, okay, that you could absolutely trust is God. My wife's grandmother was a very strong, very smart, very basic person, as you say, Rabbanu Shalom, God is the only one you can still have your problems to, because he's the only one who really understands. But really understands. And that's why, for example, that's the reason that prayer to angels, while it's common in certain Kabbalistic sections, has been excoriated. Excoriated by rabbis throughout the centuries. In fact, there were even those who don't like singing, who've opposed singing Shalom Aleichem, the prayer that you, the song, the piyut, the ritual poem that we recite on the people, the traditionalists recite when you come back from the synagogue on Friday night, because you're basically, what's the third verse? Borchuni l'shalom, bless me. You don't look to angels. You don't look to other beings other than God, to beings other than God, to bless us. Why does it exist? And there are people who do it. And if people who go to Kivrei Tzadikim, it's interesting to go. And I'll tell you in a minute why. You find that there are all kinds of pre-printed prayers which invoke the saint and asking for the saint or the person, whoever it is, to intervene with God on our behalf. So that's on the one hand. I'm not justifying, I'm just pointing out that there's something there. People do feel like they need intercession, but it really is not, Orthodox. Let's put it that way. Interestingly, in fact, Yom Kippur. Good. For those of you who want to know, Yom Kippur is in 2 months. We just had Tisha B'Av. So the Shulchan Aruch records that there is a custom to go to the cemetery on Tisha B'Av in the afternoon, and for reasons that's not really relevant right now. But Rabbi Yisrael Meir HaKohen, the author of the Mishnah Berurah, sticks in right there on that line, says, but be careful, we're not praying to the dead. We're praying to God after deriving inspiration from the dead. So the question is, okay, how does that work? So why would people be attracted to graves? So I would like to explain it, and I see we're running out of time. So we will. This is what we're going to get to today. This one line. I think we don't recognize in our era that there are different. And I think I've mentioned this before, that there are different perceptions of time, and they're very, very different. The modern world, since Descartes, certainly not long after, viewed time as linear and viewed the past as inaccessible. In other words, the past is dead. In other words, we go back. I can't get back what I said, 20 minutes ago when we started this year. I can't go back there. Time is irreversible. The traditional view of time is much more fluid. It fits... to a certain degree, fits Dalí's famous painting of the fluid clocks, or the melted clocks, which itself was based on Einstein's idea of the fluidity of time. In traditional societies, in Jewish society, Jewish time is fluid. Jewish time does not mean we're not talking about coming an hour late. Jewish time means that we can actually re-experience the past. The past is accessible emotionally and intellectually. The personae of the past, the heroes of the past, are formative, and we experience their presence. The classic expression of this is found in the Haggadah of the Passover. Haggadah b'chol dor v'dor chayav adam lerot et atzmo ki lo yatzam min Mitzrayim. In every generation, one should look at himself as if they went out of Egypt. I mean, we are going out of Egypt right now. I think that part of what attracts Jews, at least intuitively, to the graves of the pious, partly is this sort of sense of numinous sanctity of the person, of the memory of the person who's there, And the sense that this is not just somebody that I know about who lived a million years ago. It's somebody I know. I studied Chumash. I studied Mishnah. I studied Jewish history. These are people whose lives and whose deeds and whose teachings are central parts of my being. Rav Soloveitchik used to always point out that that when you study Torah, all of the generations who ever studied, including whether they're the authorities, the students, everybody's there in the room with you because it's a transgenerational dialogue. So when a person drives from Tveria south and he sees the grave of Rabbi, the putative grave of Rabbi Meir on the right hand side, and he stops, or she stops, it's not just a cenotaph with a grave. This is Rabbi Meir, and we know the stories about him and about Pruria and his relations with Elisha ben Avuya. It's a living being. Now I have to tell you who I learned this from. I learned this from exactly 50 years ago, actually. I was a kid. But exactly 50 years ago, my first time in Israel, this was the first 50 years ago, first time I ever came here. I went for the first time to Kever Rachel, which at the time was a far more intimate, far more intimate and far more accessible place. I don't like the way it looks now. It's simple. I like simplicity. And sitting next to the monument over the grave of Rachel were two little old ladies from Jerusalem. These old time, you know, they looked like they lived in the 19th century. But what was amazing about them was the fact that they were sitting and talking to Mama Rochel, no joke, as if they were talking to their best friend. They were pouring out, I mean, I was a little bit embarrassed because it was so intimate, but pouring out their hearts to Mama Rochel about the children, when they get married, as get married, the children, whatever it is, whatever people talk about. And I walked away, and I've thought about this many, many times since. Rachel, the patriarch, was with them. So it's experiencing and invoking the presence of somebody who is a formative factor in your life. We go to graves of people that we knew because we want to get close to them. Not because we think they're alive, but because there's something about being as close to their physical presence as possible, which is comforting because these are people with whom we had a relationship. So here it makes no difference if you're talking to your mother or Mama Rachel. Why? Because for Jews, time is fluid. Chasms of time are accessible. There is no such thing as dead time. There is no such thing as dead history. It's a living and vivid. So, al ta'amin ba'atzmacha ad yom motcha, what about the saints who, or special people who die afterwards? That depends on the attitude with which you approach it. You can derive inspiration from a person's life by being close to their remains, so long as you realize that they were mortal and vulnerable in their own lifetime and could not rely on themselves until the day they died, and then learn from their example. I think that's what I'm continuing the line of argument and discussion that was started by my friend Professor Safrai. I think that's a more contemporary way of looking at this Mishnah. And next time we will look at, with your permission, Al tadon et chavercha shetagielim komo, don't judge your fellow until you get to his place, I think is so self-evident that it doesn't really need discussion. So we're going to jump ahead to Al tomar davar sheyefshar lishmo ashesofo lishamea. Don't say something which should not be said, cannot be said, should be forbidden from said, or it can never, you'll say will never happen, as we'll see another way of looking at this Mishnah, because at the end it's going to happen, or because it's going to be out. Whereas I can keep a secret. It's the people that I tell that can't keep secrets. Anyways, have a great week. I hope that everybody is, if you're in Israel, I hope that you enjoy the somewhat cooler temperatures. Wherever you are around the world, it's the summer. Please enjoy if you can. You're welcome to first of all, this is sponsored by the Tel Aviv International Synagogue. Please join their daily Shiurim in Torah webpage because there's lots of great stuff there. You're welcome to share this video as much as you want. If you want comments, you can leave comments on my YouTube page. You can leave comments here, wherever you want. It's going to be on it'll be on Instagram. It'll be on YouTube. It'll be here on Facebook and on my official public figure Facebook page. Talk about pretense. And have a great day.